question or nosy question in a way, and that it's not, I think that's important for me as a filmmaker to let to know people that it's me meddling in things basically at those points.
So, Marvin, I'm gonna pivot to you because I think in the scene where you're in a discussion with a friend, you talk about how in every room it's like being a disruption. And that I think really jumped out at me. And that must have been frankly exhausting. Is that still the case, or is it more that it's the handsomeness that's the distraction now?
It's definitely the handsomeness. Now, I think we still do stand out, especially if we go out as a family, because now we are like gay-ish couple with kids, right? And the way I look right now, I don't know. There is this whole thing about with trans people about passing and not passing, and I think the whole debate is also sadly very much driven by the fact that we are pushed into these little boxes, you know. Like you have to be trans enough to deserve transition. So you have these gatekeepers at the trans clinics and these all these, you know, legal things that you have to go through. I don't know how it is in Canada, but some European countries have started accepting laws that allow self-identification, which means that as a trans person, you can basically say, I am a man, and the state will change your legal gender. And that's it. You don't have to be psychiatrized. You know, you don't have to be labeled as anything else. You can just be trusted as a person who has the right to like express who they are, right? But in Sweden, it's still not the case. So you are like still pushed into these little boxes, and you are always like judged and observed, and you are like your privacy is invaded on the most intimate level. So I don't know. I like, you know, there was a period of time when I knew that I look obviously queer. It's like anybody who looked at me saw that, okay, something isn't completely right with these gender roles there, you know, something's going on, right? And during this time, you kind of know that when you go somewhere, when you enter a room, you will have certain looks, you will have certain reactions that you have to deal with. And either you filter them out or you address them, but you always have to deal with them. So, in a way, yes, it was exhausting. From another perspective, I think it has also taught me a thing, and this is actually not from my head, this is Laverne Cox. Basically, we are trained to all the time like evaluate or estimate danger, right? You go into a room and you look at people and you go like, potential partner, danger, I don't care about him. You know, you do automatically, not consciously, you do this estimation, right? And as a trans person, you disrupt that. You make it impossible for people to categorize you if you are visibly queer, right? So they see you as danger, even though you're not dangerous at all. They just automatically go like, what's that? That's dangerous. I'm uncomfortable. And it's your fault. But as a trans person, you enter a room and you have to question yourself. Am I in danger from these people? Can I come in here? Can I go to this toilet? Can I go to this changing room? Or is it just me being anxious? Is it just me being nervous and uncomfortable, right? You question yourself all the time, and you train yourself to like really listen to people's reactions, really try to read them. And I think that, you know, if it were the other way around, if the people really like try to ask themselves, why is this person making me uncomfortable? Are they really dangerous? Or is it just my prejudice? You know, is it just my discomfort? It would make it life a lot of easier for everybody else.
The
Anyway.
sad reality is that incidents of anti-trans violence in Canada are significantly up, and I think that that is likely true in Europe and in one of the things that jumped out at me near the start of your documentary, and I kind of kept a sideways eye on it throughout it, and maybe this was a focal point or not. And it is around performative gender and the idea of, yeah, and I think you brought it up a little bit here around passing privilege. Did you feel, well, it's sort of a two-part question. Did you feel that you have to be more masculine in order to kind of demonstrate the point? And my follow-up to that is, how did that play out with your husband, Ivan?
You're completely right. It was there, and I'm very happy you picked on that.
There's so many facets to this, so many sides to this question. In the beginning, I didn't really know what I was doing. I was like, okay, because in Sweden, you have already deconstructed the gender roles as much as possible, right? It's like there's been this whole emancipation process. Feminism is a really powerful movement in Sweden, and you have like a really, in that, in the sense, quite evolved society when it comes to the self-awareness, you know, what is patriarchy and all of these issues that the issues that women face in a society. So from this point of view, I think I had it a little bit easier because it was like already, it wasn't dramatic at all. It wasn't about like trying to fit in into some kind of masculine role, because there was no set masculine role. You know, the people that I knew here, the friends that I have here, despite the fact that David says they didn't have this typical, like, you know, who has the pants on at home, you know, kind of division, you know. But at the same time, I was questioning a lot about, like, okay, what are the parts of, because I felt like I have to get rid of some parts of the femininity, right? I'm transitioning. I have to get rid of my feminine traits. Like, that was like the first kind of thought that I have. And then I realized that the traits that I was actually getting rid of during the transition weren't at all like typical female characteristics. There were like things that I would want to get rid of in any case. Stupid habits that you pick up during your life that you would never question, you know, the things that came with my upbringing, you know, as a Czech person, as a teenager in the 90s, in a society that was very pink and blue, you know, and a gap in between. So, I mean, if I were a woman, I would have wanted to get rid of those as well. So it kind of made me look at gender as a, something else completely.
I don't know if it was frustrating in the filmmaking process, because I think I could count how many words I even said on one hand. Was that a challenge to balance not prying, but, you know, because obviously the relationship formed a key sort of common thread throughout the documentary. Was it a challenge to make sure that Ivan's perspective was accurately portrayed for a man of few words?
Well, I'm still not sure if we did it right, but I hope so. Yeah, well, do you know what? When we started, of course, I focused on Marvin at first. But very soon, it came to my mind and perception that I have to focus on Ivan, I would say even equally in the story. And yeah, well, for the whole time he kept telling me, he basically stayed in the same kind of position, and he kept telling me, for my like prying and nosy questions, he was like, I don't know, you know, I will feel like we'll see when we get there. You know, like I don't know how I will feel. And I did not object to that, because I felt that he's actually very honest in that it is not something that he is not trying to avoid answers. He's basically really genuinely in that position. And at some point, like, we didn't know when we will stop shooting. I knew that we will probably stop when the visual change will be visible on camera, which is a very simple solution. But it, in the end, seemed to work, because as you changed Marvin, you, things started to wrap up. I would say, naturally, by themselves. When we were shooting, when it was our last time in Sweden shooting with the crew, and I asked Ivan, like, okay, so I keep asking you the same question, so please answer me, how do you feel? So, like, things changed, Marvin has beard, and, like, everything changed, basically. So how do you feel? And he said, yeah, you know what? Yeah, well, it's probably behind us. I don't care anymore. And I was like, yes. But
jeez.
Yeah, I don't want to spoil the film for you. But there's this last conversation I have with Ivan sitting at the pier after his run. And I ask him, so how do you feel? And he answers, and I won't tell you what does he say. You both know because you seen the movie. But the way he answers me, it blew my mind at the moment when we were sitting there, because this person who really doesn't like to talk about his feelings, and it's something which is like not something which he would do normally. He expresses himself in the most simple and beautiful way, and I had literally tears in my eyes. So that made me really happy, and that's for me the essence of happiness, basically. Simplicity of human feelings. It's beautiful.
I think that that's something that really, and you know, when I started the interview, I mentioned how it was the humanity in this documentary that is so palpable, you know, and it is the how people evolve after significant changes. And I think it is so. I think that anyone listening to this can easily identify with some of those experiences in terms of major changes and how that's impacted yourself and those that you love around you. And I think that the beauty of that storytelling is incredibly well done. So congratulations, Sonia, for a fantastic job on creating that. But yeah, I cannot recommend it enough to anyone out there to go and in, you know, T-minus 60 minutes, if you're you can hot foot it to the Toronto Hot Docs premiere. If not, if you're on Toronto on Sunday, May 7th, around 8 p.m., you can catch it there. If not, you got picked up by HBO Max, so congratulations on that. That's excellent news. And Bell's Crave should have that, touch wood, very soon as well. Are there any closing comments that you'd like to share with our audience?
Just keep an open mind. And I think that this film is really for everyone, basically. So just come and watch it for yourself. And thank you for this interview. We had plenty of interviews, and this was actually... I shouldn't say that, but the best one. Thank you.
I appreciate that. I think it comes from, you know, knowing the threads to pull on, for sure. Well, thank you both. My next step is to actually get a hold of some of the books that you've written, Marvin. The excerpts alone were enough to pique my interest.
Approach it, you know, when you go to a really good Asian restaurant and you don't know any of the things on the menu, right? Mm-hmm. And you just see the number of the chili peppers, okay? Just pick one with the least number of chili peppers as a first timer. Okay? That's my only recommendation.
Gotta work my way into it. Okay, noted. Well, thank you so much again. Everyone should go see A Happy Man, and we will be back just after this.
If I say please 1,000 ways, would you stay with me? If I say thank you,
thank you, thank you,
would you stay? Could you stay? I'll give you a million reasons why. If you would just stay with me, I would grow wings, I'd learn to fly. if you'd stay, could you? I'll take a trip, trip back in time and space. I'll erase all trace of shadow, the rain of someone blame. It seems a shame, such a shame. And you and I are ships that were just passing by. Goodbye.
And welcome back to Can Queer, home of Canada's queer media. My name is still Luke Smith. And when we recorded that interview, we very much thought that Sebastian would be joining me back in the studio. However, he was unavailable. I want to turn now to a report issued by a rather out there reporting organisation. It is His Majesty's Inspectorate of the Constabulary and Fire and Rescue Services, or the HMICFRS for short. Now, this report by the Inspector Constabulary of the Fire and Rescue Service was commissioned by the British Mayor of London, Sadiq Khan, who, after 8 years following the Stephen Port serial killing — so Stephen Port was a gay man who killed young gay men in London between 2014 and 2015. He was arrested eventually, and they has been very, very critical of the police. Now, what this report by the Inspectorate of the Constabulary of the Fire and Rescue Service — that is a tongue twister — they have accused the London Metropolitan Police of a calamitous litany of failures. That is a calamitous litany of failures. Most notably, in the 139-page report, they were critical of the London Metropolitan Police's response, their oversight of junior officers being poor, their record-keeping being unacceptable, the use of intelligence is frankly inadequate. Some constables reported that if they're able to draw the line between two crimes, it has more to do with luck than it has to do with judgment. This, for example, those who aren't familiar with the serial killer Stephen Port in London — he killed four young gay men — and some of the police that responded to these murders were responding to more than one of them. So they were responding, like, they were at more than one, and yet lines were not
drawn. Now, Sadiq Khan, the the mayor of London, has now echoed calls by the public demanding a public inquiry into how the London Metropolitan Police investigated, and particularly the failings of individual officers, potentially, but also the systemic failings of the London Metropolitan Police. It seems that some of the recommendations made to improve the London Metropolitan Police have been very reluctantly followed. There was an independent review by the Baroness Louise Casey, who found recently, I think it was a couple of months ago we reported on this, that the London Metropolitan Police was institutionally homophobic, misogynistic, racist, and offered other forms of discrimination in the service. And harassment was very often just ignored. This on top of a coroner's report into the murders by Stephen Porter also found that the London Metropolitan Police had failed. The former police commissioner, Crusader Dick, eventually resigning in amidst all of these scandals. Whether or not this new report that founds yet again failing by the London Metropolitan Police will lead to any changes in the largest police force in Britain in terms of how they respond to the LGBT community and LGBTQ murders remains to be seen. This is relevant to a Canadian audience as well. And the reason why this is so relevant is because the Bruce MacArthur murders happened around a very similar time frame. I believe it was 2010 to 2017. Stephen Porter was operating from 2014 and 2015. Now, it's worth noting that the Toronto Police Service went on a bit of a wild goose hunt looking for a non-existent cannibal for a short period of time, and the independent judicial review into the Toronto Police response and the Bruce MacArthur murders can only be described, quite frankly, as utterly scathing. The service opted purposefully to not participate in a national missing persons database, meaning that drawing connections between all of these missing peoples was like blood from a stone. Toronto Police also, at one point, there was a quote that sort of heard around the world by then police chief Mark Saunders, who said, and I quote here, "We knew that people were missing and we didn't have the right answers," he told the Globe and Mail. And he goes on to say, "But nobody was coming to with us with anything." Now, what was broadly described as completely tone deaf by, at the time, Toronto Police Chief Mark Saunders, in terms of the Toronto Police response, has even further been criticised in the Independent Judicial Review, which found that Toronto Police Service repeatedly ignored input from members of the community, many of whom were advocating for awareness of the fact that there is a serial killer, Bruce MacArthur, or there was, operating in the Toronto Village for a number of years before TPS eventually, finally found him and arrested him. I say detained him, I should say, because they had already previously arrested him and then let him go again before he made subsequent murders. So Toronto Police Service certainly bungled that particular case, and the independent judicial review was, as I mentioned before, scathing. The leadership of Toronto Police at the time, being the at the time Chief Mark Saunders, people now recognize him as, I believe he is now running for the Mayor of Toronto seat. So the London Metropolitan Police in London looking at how can they fix their mistakes following the Stephen Port murders. Now, whether or not Toronto Police is also looking to follow up on the recommendations of the Independent Judicial Inquiry, we're going to reach out to them and see what improvements, if any, have been made. But both of these serial killers happened at roughly around the same time, and both police services were ignoring the gay community, much to a terrible, terrible consequence. Unfortunately, there were other news stories that we haven't had time to catch up on that we will catch up on next week. Earlier, you heard the fantastic track by Meishi called Nothing Lasts Forever. And we're coming now to Holding On by Jolly Wolf. I've been Nick Smith. The Sexual Violence Support and Prevention Office, SVSPO, offers confidential support, advice, and referrals to SFU and FIC community members, including students, staff, and faculty, who have been impacted by sexual violence and misconduct. The SVSPO is a welcoming place where you can access support without judgment or assumptions. We work from a survivor-centered perspective, using an empowerment and trauma-informed approach that considers individual situations and perspectives. Please reach out. Services are located at the Diamond Alumni Center, room 014 on the lower level. Please reach out by email at sv-support@sfu.ca.
That was sv-support@sfu.ca.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM in Burnaby, British Columbia, broadcasting from the unceded territories of the Coast Salish peoples. Find us online at cjsf.ca, on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and SoundCloud.